Well, this evening, we are going to continue our study in the book of Daniel. And if you were unable or did not realize that they were out there, there are some pages of notes out there on the table. If you want to go and get those or whatever, you're welcome to. We are looking, starting in chapter 2 tonight, which I know we looked at chapter 3 this morning, and so it's a little bit weird to be going back and forth, but we're going to look at just some of these stories in the morning, as I shared before, and then we will be looking at some of the more detailed information in our Sunday evening time. So I invite you to look at Daniel chapter 2. We'll begin looking at Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and we'll start out with the circumstances of that dream. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Now, the first question that I have in regard to the timing of this is, this is the second year, it says, of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, when was Daniel taken captive? It was on Nebuchadnezzar's way back to take the throne, right? Y'all remember that? 605 BC, Daniel and his buddies were taken captive and taken back to Babylon, and that's when Nebuchadnezzar took over for his father as the king of Babylon from King Nabopolassar. And so 605 BC, now what did Daniel do whenever he first got to Babylon? Do you remember? What was it, Miss Patricia? You're shaking your head. Right. What was he going through when all of that was taking place? Why was he given the king's food? What was his life situation he was in? He was in a 3-year training program, a school of sorts, training him how to be an attendant in the king's court. All right? So here's my question. In this story, we find Daniel serving the king. He's already finished his training. How can that be true if it says in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. How could Daniel have finished a 3-year training program and Nebuchadnezzar only be in his second year of his reign? Okay? Have you ever thought about this before? A lot of people try to use these kind of details to say, this is why the Bible is not historically accurate. Because there is an apparent discrepancy. There is an apparent error. However, as a church and as an individual, I believe that God's word is the inspired, inerrant word of God, meaning there are no errors. It is accurate and true in every word and syllable. So how do we justify this? That's what I want us to take a few minutes to look at. So how could Daniel have completed 3 years of training by Nebuchadnezzar's second year? Now, this is taking place during Nebuchadnezzar's second year as king. Now, considering that Daniel's training, I may have already covered all of this. Let me stop here for a second. Okay, considering that Daniel's training was 3 years, it might seem that this would conflict with the timetable described in this verse. But we must remember the difference in the Babylonian and the Hebrew systems for counting the number of years that a leader was in power. Daniel probably used the Babylonian system, which did not count a king's year of accession. By Babylonian reckoning, Daniel's second year of training occurred during what was considered the first year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Therefore, the king sought interpretation of his dreams in 602 BC, shortly after Daniel had finished his 3-year education. Now, To make this simple, if you have the notes, I included there a chart in those notes. And on that chart, you have in the left column the years of training. Daniel's first year, second year, third year, and the dates of that training. Starting September 605 BC, that was the time that Nebuchadnezzar assumed the throne, and going through Nisan, March or April of 604 BC. So that first year of training was actually not a full year. It was like September to March or April. And then the second year was Nisan to Nisan of 604 to 603. And then the third year, 603 to 602. And that is a typo. I hate it when I do that, Patricia. I should have sent it to you first because she's the best editor. If you need something edited, Patricia's your person. So that's the first, second, and third year of his training. Now, if you look at the year of the king's reign, next to that first year of Daniel's training, you would write in the word accession, okay? A-C-C-E-S-S-I-O-N. That is his accession year. That was when he became the king over Babylon. That was what they called it. It was his accession year. Then the second year of Daniel's training would then be considered the first year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, because they considered the second chronological year as the first year, because the first year is the accession year. Does that make sense? Okay? And so when the Bible says that in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, then this is very possible and very likely that this was shortly after Daniel finished his third year of training in March or April of 602 BC. So he's fresh out of college, so to speak. Okay? And so that's the time frame around these dreams that Nebuchadnezzar had. So any questions about that? Is that clear as mud now? Okay. Moving on, let's talk about these dreams for a moment. See, the dreams disturbed him so much that he could not continue to sleep. The phrase, his spirit was troubled, could also be translated as his spirit was struck. All right? And this is the idea of striking something like with a hammer striking an anvil, or a hammer striking a bell, all right? So this isn't just that he was troubled. This, I mean, you know how jolting it is to strike an anvil with a hammer. Anybody ever done that before? All right? I mean, the noise, the vibration, it sent his whole body into shock. Basically. In fact, it probably connected with the rapid beat of his heart due to extreme agitation, is what one author says. Has this ever happened to you? Have you ever experienced a dream so disturbing that you were unable to go back to sleep? I mean, basically what happened here is that Nebuchadnezzar was freaked out. All right? He was totally messed up. And so he wanted something to happen. He wanted people to help him to understand what these dreams meant. And so let's look at chapter 2, verses 2 through 13. In these verses, we find some people that work for Nebuchadnezzar as wise men. And, you know, satraps and magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and the Chaldeans, which we've learned also means astrologers. And so I want us to talk just a little bit about these things, because you know what? We had Marty Boone, the magic balloon man, here the other night, and he did a magic trick. Oh, it was the funniest thing, y'all. Just a quick one. We were up in this youth room, and he was doing this trick where he's got a tube of balls, and it's got a tube that's a little bit bigger, and there's a ball inside, and so he's putting them in a certain order, and it looks like the red ball goes through the yellow and green ball and ends up on bottom. I mean, it's a simple trick if you got the right stuff. We had the lights on in the youth room, and he couldn't see the colors, and he put the balls in the wrong order. And so you know, that's our mindset of magicians, right? You know, just doing card tricks or you know, things like that. I was watching, I don't know if you ever watched the show on DIY Network called Man Caves. It's got Tony Saragosa, the former NFL football player, and he did a card trick on the show the other day that I was watching. I think I recorded it last July or something. But anyway, that's what we think of when we think of magicians. Card tricks, parlor tricks, you know, sleight of hand and this sort of stuff. Actually, this concept of a magician in a Babylonian culture, the word literally means an engraver, a writer. Only in a derivative sense does it mean someone who possesses a knowledge of the occult or a diviner or astrologer. So this is really someone who was like a scribe. They would be the ones engraving in stone or wrote with a stylus on clay tablets. And in this case, the religious scribes are sacred writers who recorded and preserved the materials used in Babylonian religious activities. So that was, when we say magicians, that is strictly speaking of what these men did. These wise men meticulously chronicled the movements of heavenly bodies in order to gain religious wisdom from them. Now, in our culture today, that's not what magicians are. They're seen as people who do tricks and entertain crowds. But in the Babylonian culture, magicians performed serious functions. Supposedly, they were in touch with the world of the spirits and the gods. These individuals were the advisors to the king on virtually every matter that came before him. So it's not exactly what we think of when we think of a magician. Now, the next one is the enchanters. The enchanters. This is also translated in the New Revised Standard Version as astrologers, or in the New American Standard Bible, it's translated as conjurers. And this word literally means conjurer or necromancer. And if you're unfamiliar with the concept of necromancy, necromancy is basically the ability to talk to the dead. All right? It's serving like a medium or something like that. And most likely this word that is translated here is a loan word from the Babylonian language. So enchanters with their magic spells and incantations were believed to be able to communicate with the spirit world. And with the rise of certain modern religious movements, communicating with the spirit world through mediums or channels is again becoming popular. And by the way, the Bible, the Old Testament talks about this a lot and calls it witchcraft or sorcery. And the Bible condemns it, working through mediums. But that's what these enchanters were. They were conjurers or mediums to speak with the spirit world. Now, the next group that we find here are sorcerers. The sorcerers, this word likely refers to a religious group known from Akkadian texts as the Kashapu. And so this is an Akkadian loan word, which means to practice sorcery or witchcraft. So, you know, this word, sorcerers, it means exactly what we have in mind, okay? It is that warlock, that sorcerer, that witch. That's the kind of person that these were. And then finally, the Chaldeans were the last group that were called in to interpret the king's dreams. And as we've talked about on several occasions, Chaldeans, in an ethnic sense, referred to all Babylonians, but in a restricted sense, it referred to astrologers or fortune tellers, people who looked into the stars and tried to tell your fortunes or predict your future based on what they're seeing in the stars. And so they believed that the movements of the heavenly bodies could somehow determine someone's eternal destiny. Now, the interesting thing that I discovered is that these guys were very, very meticulous, okay? These Chaldeans or these astrologers were very meticulous. I was reading from one author who wrote this. He said, study of the movements of heaven, of the heavenly bodies was not performed primarily as a scientific enterprise, but this led to the Chaldeans, this led the Chaldeans to record carefully the movements of the moon, stars, planets, and comets, an exercise that did have scientific value. Whitcomb points out that such accurate records were kept that the Babylonian astronomer, and I'm going to try to say his name, but I've never heard of it before. It is Narumanu, okay? Narumanu. But this is a guy that lived about 500 B.C., so a little bit, you know, 100 years after Daniel. But this particular astronomer was able to calculate the length of the year as being 365 days, 6 hours, 15 minutes, and 41 seconds, which, by the way, is only 26 minutes and 55 seconds off what modern astronomy tells us. 2,500 years ago, he calculated it down to within 27 minutes of accurate. These guys were meticulous. And so the last thing that I want to point out, we've looked at these different roles of these different people, and we've talked about, you know, this is what they did and this is what they did, and it might or might not match up to what we understand. What we need to realize is that the individual wise men and the people that are mentioned here may have had different duties, and the various names given for these persons probably indicated what those duties were, but we should not press them to be technical distinctions. All right? The key here is that all of these different men were advisors to the king. So in chapter 2, we find that the king calls all of these men. And so what did the king say to these men when he called them? What did he say? Do you remember? He said, I had a terrible dream. And so how did the Chaldeans respond? They said, tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. And he said, no. You tell me the dream and the interpretation. We'll get to that in a second. Now, the interesting thing is that there is something that happens with the original text here that's very important. And we've talked about this in passing, but I wanted to remind you, here in the middle of verse 4, it says, then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. It's at that point when it has the words, and they said in Aramaic, that Daniel begins to write in Aramaic. And he continues from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through the end of chapter 7. So why two different languages? Why is this? I mean, no other book in the Bible is written half in one and half in the other. Why are there two different languages? Well, the Aramaic sections include Daniel's memoirs, the story of the three Hebrew children, Nebuchadnezzar's experiences, and the prophecies of the four kingdoms. And we talked about those four kingdoms this morning a little bit, how that it was the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires. And so all of these things were important to the world at large, okay? These were issues that dealt with Gentile nations and Gentile kingdoms. And so Daniel wrote these things in what is called the lingua franca, or the common language of the day. He wrote it in the language that would be understood by everyone, not just the Hebrews. The Hebrews understood Hebrew, but everyone in the world at that time spoke Aramaic. It was the common language. So chapters 2 through 7 are written so that non-Jews could understand it, because these were messages from God to these Gentile kingdoms. But when you look at the Hebrew sections, which are chapter 1 and then chapters 8 through 12, The Hebrew was written in Hebrew because it was a message to the Hebrew people. Chapter 1 tells the story of the exiled Jewish youths who were sent to Babylon during the final days of the kingdom of Judah. And then chapters 8 through 12 are written in Hebrew because they speak particularly of the fate of the Jews under a tyrannical leader, Antiochus IV, as well as it talks about, and we're going to get into all this, and y'all pray for me as I prepare. I was telling someone earlier, this is my first time to ever teach the book of Daniel, and there's a lot here. But chapters 8 through 12 go very deep into the eschatological teachings about the Antichrist. In other words, these are prophecies that are still yet to come in our future. And those were written to God's people. Therefore, they were written in Hebrew because they would not be relevant to the Gentile world. So thus, Aramaic was reserved for the parts of the book that had a universal appeal or special relevance to Gentile nations. And Hebrew was used for the stuff that pertained to the Jews. So going back to the text, we found that the king has said, this is what I want you to do. I want you to tell me my dream. They said, okay, tell me your dream and we'll interpret it for you. And he said, no. The ridiculous expectation that the king had of the interpreters was that he wanted the wise men not to just interpret, but also to tell them the details. He wanted a divine answer, not something that someone had made up that sounded believable. And, you know, we talked about this last week. It's safe to say that Nebuchadnezzar felt like this dream somehow had bearing on his future. And I showed you a picture this morning on our slide presentation, and I have it there in your notes. But this guy that, you know, this statue that he had a dream about, this guy was scary. I mean, he totally messed with Nebuchadnezzar's mind. He was afraid of what was going to happen. And so he was likely afraid that it represented the fall of his kingdom. And so, you know, in that regard, he sure didn't want to tell those people that are next in line for the throne what this dream was, okay? And so what did the king say would happen to them if they could not interpret the dream? Well, we've talked about this, and that they would be dismembered. They would be torn limb from limb. I think that's King Nebuchadnezzar's standard operating procedure for punishment. I'm going to tear your body into pieces. And I discovered in my studies that dismemberment of enemies was a practice that was widespread throughout the Orient. And this was no idle threat by Nebuchadnezzar, because we find in 2 Kings 25 very harsh treatment of King Zedekiah. And then in Jeremiah 29, we find another guy named Zedekiah, not King Zedekiah, and a guy named Ahab that King Nebuchadnezzar treated very harshly, not to mention what we studied this morning in Daniel chapter 3 about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. King Nebuchadnezzar had no qualms about exacting harsh punishment. And so these people believed him when he said, my decision is firm. I am going to do this. Why would Nebuchadnezzar be willing to annihilate his wise men? Well, I think we already talked about that a little bit in that they could be the ones that are trying to overthrow him, is what he's thinking. But also, their inability to acquire the necessary information to interpret the dream is proof that they really weren't in touch with the spirit world. So, you know, it's kind of like if we're hiring a roofer to go and do a job. If they can't do the job, then we don't have a problem firing them, right? Well, if these wise men couldn't do the job, Nebuchadnezzar didn't have any problem firing them. Maybe in a different type of fire, though, or dismemberment. And so they weren't in touch with it, with the spirit world like they said they were. So how did the king react? They could not tell the interpretation of the dream, so how did he react? He reacted in a fit of rage and ordered all of them to be killed. And it was at that point in time that Daniel intervened. He was visited by a man named Arioch, and when Arioch came to visit him, he intervened. Now, who was Arioch? We find him in chapter 14, in verse 14 of chapter 2. The scripture says that he was the king's captain, or some translations say that he was the commander of the king's guard. The interesting thing that I discovered is that the root word for guard in the Aramaic means to slay. So literally, this king's guard was really a group of executioners. All right, this was the king's hit squad. They were going out to do wet work, so to speak. They were going out to kill all of these wise men. Daniel probably knew who Arioch was. You know, he was part of the court. And so Arioch was the chief executioner for King Nebuchadnezzar. And so when Arioch showed up, he asked Arioch for two things. First, a reason for the urgency behind the king's command to kill all of them. And second, he asked for extra time. Now, if you'll notice there in verse 15, he said, he declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Now, in most literal translations of the Bible, the idea conveyed here is that the decree was an urgent decree or a hasty decree. But the idea that is meant that this means, the idea that this meant hasty seems to be derived because the same word is used in chapter 3, verse 22, when it says that he did it urgently or hastily. But here in this passage, based on the context in the original language, it's really more of an idea of his harshness. And so Daniel's asking the question, one way or another, you know, it depends on your understanding. Daniel's saying, why is this happening so fast? Or Daniel's saying, why is the king being so harsh? But either way, he asked then, can you give me more time? Let me inquire of my God. And so what was the result of the intervention? He met with the king to request, or with the king's captain to request more time to interpret the dream. And you know, I found it interesting that he did this before the dream was revealed to him. And that's why we, when we talked about this last week, we talked about having trust in the midst of trials, facing the execution squad, but trusting that God would provide them with the answers. And so Daniel was granted a stay of execution, so to speak, from the kill squad. And so Daniel had a plan. What was Daniel's plan for discerning the content and the interpretation of the dream? Do you remember? What did Daniel do? He went home and he and his friends had a prayer meeting. And in that prayer meeting, Daniel was revealed the content of this dream and its interpretation through a vision. So what did he do next? Well, after God answered their prayer by revealing the matter to Daniel, Daniel responded by uttering a great prayer of thanksgiving. And we find this in chapter 2, verses 20 through 23. And so when God answered his prayer, Daniel praised God and thanked God for his wisdom and his might before he went to King Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 20, that's what he says. Thank you, God. I praise you for your wisdom and your power. In verse 21, he says that he is praising him, that he is in control of the whole world and everything in it. In verse 22, he praises God for revealing the deep hidden things to someone like him. And then in verse 23, He praises God for answering their specific request. And, you know, whenever you have that opportunity to be in prayer and ask God for something very specific, it's such a blessing to get that specific answer that meets your need. And that so Daniel took time and praised God for it. In verses 31 through 35, Daniel has made his way to the king. And now we're seeing the dream revealed, and Daniel is telling what this dream is. And you have some of this in your notes, and the question is what did the king see in his dream? And the first thing that he saw was a statue that was mighty and exceedingly bright. It was a statue that frightened him. It was something that was very scary. And now the anatomy of this statue was that the head was made of gold, the chest and the arms were made of silver, the middle, the belly area, and the thighs were made of bronze, the legs were made of iron, and the feet were made of iron and clay. The other thing that he saw besides the statue in this dream, it was that he saw a stone that was hewn by God that struck the statue's feet and broke them into pieces, thus destroying the statue completely. And that stone then became a great mountain. And the third thing he saw a statue, he saw a stone, but he also saw a strong wind. Because at the end of the dream, it tells us that the strong wind blew away all of the remnants of that broken statue as if it were chaff from wheat. And so this was the contents of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The interpretation then, Daniel tells him in the following verses 36 through 45. But I love the fact that before Daniel shared with Nebuchadnezzar what this dream meant, he took a moment and he spent some time articulating something very important. Notice what he says in verse 36. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. Notice that he says we. Did you see that? Now, some scholars will say, well, that must mean that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were with him. They're not mentioned anywhere here. I disagree with that understanding. I think Daniel is so in tune to what God is saying here that he's saying, now the Lord and I are going to tell you what this interpretation means. He goes on, you, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beast of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them, you are the head of gold. Now, I love the fact that he tells Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold, but God is the one who puts you there. Do you see that? In fact, one of the books that I'm using as a help in my studies is a book by Renald Showers. And the book's title is The Most High God. And it's a great title for a commentary on the book of Daniel, because over and over and over again, we find here in the book of Daniel that God is preeminent. God is in control. God is over all things. And so that's exactly what he tells Nebuchadnezzar. He declared that it was the God of heaven, not the Babylonian gods, nor the king himself, who had made Nebuchadnezzar the top ruler of the then known world. Realize this was the prominent empire that covered all of the known world at that time. So Daniel was determined, however, to not sacrifice the truth of God on the altar of expediency. What do you mean by that, Brother Wade? I mean, he was not willing. I mean, think about it. The king has just threatened to kill him if he couldn't do this. I would be wanting to make nice with the king, right? If the chief executioner had shown up at my door, I would be wanting to make nice with the king. But he doesn't. He points out to the king, look, it is the God of heavens, not the God of Babylon, the gods of Babylon, and not your power and your might that have put you into this place. And so I'm going to finish with this tonight. Since we had our business meeting time before, we're not going to be able to get into all the big details, but I want to finish with this question. In general terms, what was the meaning of the dream? In general terms. Well, Daniel explained the dream as a panorama of four great Gentile empires. Okay? Four great empires are what is being explained here in this dream. Virtually all scholars agree that the different parts of the statue represent empires or kingdoms, although there is some disagreement concerning their identification, especially the further down you go. So it's important to know that in the interpretation, Daniel moved progressively from the top of the image down to the bottom. And this downward movement represented the passage of time. Thus, the upper parts of the image portrayed earlier history, and the lower parts portrayed later history. And God tells Daniel that this statue represents succeeding kingdoms. Each kingdom, if you'll notice the text, it says each kingdom is inferior to the previous kingdom. And so then finally, the rock represents a kingdom which God will set up and which will never be destroyed. It destroys the other kingdoms, but it will not be destroyed. So when we come back together in 2 weeks, because next Sunday night is Fifth Sunday, we won't be having Bible study time. When we come back together, we're going to start talking about what's the meaning behind the head of gold and the arms and chest of silver and the belly and the thighs of bronze and the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay. And we'll look at each one of these and check out Nebuchadnezzar's response and move on into chapter 3 next time. All right? Are there any questions? All right. Well, thank you for your time tonight. Thank you for letting us take care of some of those business issues that we had to take care of. And we just ask that you be in prayer for the process of finding the right man to fill the role of the student pastor. And again, I'm excited about what God has in store for us. And he's led us to a lot of great guys. I can't wait till we find the right one, because I know that he's going to be just right for us. And that I know it's a little difficult to be patient, but I'm excited about it. Three, but yes. All right. All right. Well, is there any word before we're dismissed? Not hearing anything, let's stand, and we will be dismissed in prayer. Thank you for being here tonight. I pray you have a great week, and that God, you'll stay close to God in your walk each and every day. All right. Spencer Pitts, would you lead us in a word of prayer?